You're listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Well, hello, Scott.
Hey, how's it going, Mike?
Good. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here. Glad to be here.
Scott, for those that haven't come across you online, give us your name and tell our listeners why we're talking today.
Sure. I'm Scott Newman. I own a small independent pharmacy in Chesapeake, Virginia, Newman Family Pharmacy. I'm also the president of Pharmacists United for Truth and Transparency.
What's the acronym?
PUTT.
P-U-T-T.
Mm-hmm.
So Pharmacists United for Truth and Transparency.
Yep. The history of the organization is about 10 years old now. I've been with it for the last probably about 5 years or so, mostly in the background for a couple of years. And then obviously, you know, on the board about a year and a half ago. Actually, it's been a little longer than that. 2 Augusts ago, I joined the board. And then January of last year, I became president of the organization. It was originally established when Lipitor went generic, and the group was kind of the original founding members were really just trying to figure out why you could buy brand Lipitor with a $4 coupon and get around using what would have been a cost-saving generic. And of course, we've morphed into the current state where we're basically a patient and independent pharmacy and pharmacy profession advocates fighting against the pharmacy benefit manager problem.
That's interesting. Let's start there. Let's start with that exact example that you're talking about. So the Lipitor, the $4 coupon, tell the listeners, and most of the listeners, a good portion are pharmacists, but some are maybe just listening in. So explain that in terms of what exactly happened in that and why did that raise people awareness up?
Well, we raised independent pharmacy awareness because I believe it was one of the first coupons where you could actually buy directly from the manufacturer online. And that was what one of the bigger issues with the independent guys that started the group, I believe. I haven't spoken to them individually, but that's kind of the story that we hear. And it makes sense if you think about it, because all of a sudden the drug manufacturers are direct marketing to consumers with a coupon to keep their brand product prominent and their income not lost from that blockbuster drug. So ultimately it came down to, just forming an organization to try to expose some of the shenanigans that happened in the background in general. And of course, you know, pharma, up until the last few years and even currently still get blamed for a lot of the reason why drugs cost so high, but you know, we all know that there's another storyline there. They certainly have a little bit of culpability, but ultimately I think that they're kind of at the mercy of public opinion legislators and ultimately are, you know, kind of slave to the PBM like we are.
And when you say pharma, you're talking, for the listeners, that's the manufacturers mainly.
Yeah, drug manufacturers.
All right, so take me back to this $4 thing you mentioned. This would have been that the brand name Lipitor had a coupon out that people could get it for $4?
Yeah, so, you know, anytime a drug has lost its patent and there's generic competition, you know, manufacturers have employed many, many tactics, a lot that aren't legal any longer and a lot that still are that they're trying to correct to keep their market share. And one of the things that they did at that time was you have a drug that's lost patent, which is atorvastatin, and now you've got generic manufacturers coming out after the 6-month exclusivity period, releasing, you know, multi-source generic product.
Yeah.
That is, ultimately like kind and quality, and released it at a discounted rate, obviously, because that's what generics are supposed to do, is reduce costs and make things more affordable.
Right.
Well, that's a big hit to, you know, a drug manufacturer's bottom line to lose that type of income. So in order to pad their stats a little bit, they may offer a coupon, and either it's a copay coupon, and a lot of times they'll offer up to a certain amount, but usually maybe $100, you know, $50, $100. And most people's copays, at least at that time, allowed for us to bill the branded drug with a patient-specific requested DAW code, and then ultimately bill the card secondary so that they only had a $4 coupon instead of like a second or third tier $30 or $40 copay. And ultimately that kind of came down to keeping, you know, why are we purposefully doing this to pad, you know, numbers for the drug company, but we're billing the insurance company for the majority of that brand product, you know, that might be upwards of, you know, 3 to 4 times more expensive than the new generics that were on the market. So how do you justify that in healthcare? You're contributing to the rising healthcare costs because of this marketing tactic, basically. And ultimately, these guys just had a little bit more of a moral compass and wanted to expose that they were keeping costs of this medication high deliberately for profit.
That is really interesting. And so it wasn't so much like, hey, we want truth and transparency so we can be the one group of independent pharmacists out of the whole nation of healthcare providers to make sure that we're okay. It was actually coming at it like, wait a minute, this isn't, it's maybe sort of affecting us, but something's not right here.
Well, you also have to remember, though, that, like, you know, pharmacies do have a financial interest as well. I don't think that the motivation is the same for everybody as it is for some of the larger corporations. But, you know, the motivation is this. Why am I still spending this much on a branded product? Yeah, ultimately, the patient gets, you know, a reduced copay
right.
that may be close to their generic product, but I'm spending more money buying the branded drug.
Right.
And I'm also not getting paid as well because you may have, you know, a couple bucks that you might make on the branded drug, but ultimately your margin is going to be better dispensing a generic in theory.
Yes, I see. So the pharmacists are looking and saying, something's just seems odd here. We're making a couple of bucks on this. We're buying it for hundreds of dollars. There's something cheaper out there. They're getting a coupon and only paying $4 from it. There's some transparency here that we're not seeing. And there's a truth going on, even though it's a malevolent truth. There's a truth going on somewhere that we don't know about, that we as pharmacists want to get together and expose all of this.
Correct.
So that's the beginning of PUT.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So then you come in. How long have you owned your pharmacy, Scott?
I opened in around March of 2013. So I'm just in my seventh year now.
All right. You're in your seventh year. And after a couple years of that, you said you've been with PUT about 5 years?
Yeah, so when I first opened, you know, I had a lot of time on my hands other than, you know, trying to grow the RX volume. So I became kind of active on, you know, owner websites at the time because there really wasn't a whole lot of social media groups like we have now, which have kind of sprung up, you know, in the last 2 or 3 years.
Right.
So I came across, you know, PDS had an open forum. And I joined the talking forum there, which is where I also met my vice president, Dawn, who's down in Cocoa, Florida. She and I connected because she opened, I guess, about a month or two around the time I did.
Okay.
And, she ultimately, we reached out to each other. Anyway, so I joined PUT around the same time that this is kind of in deep, but like the punch lawsuit that Mark Cooker is actually getting around to filing right now, back then, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, you know, they were, a lot of the PUT members at the time were kind of posting on PDS about this punch lawsuit. So I ended up joining PUT then, I think probably around 2015-ish or so, just as a,
gotcha.
just as a donating member.
Yeah, right.
And ultimately just, you know, Dawn and I had stayed in touch because we were growing around the same time and looking for opportunities.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the reimbursement model changed significantly about 4 or 5 years ago. But
yeah.
I kind of get involved because I like to complain. I certainly like to, you know, I don't like to just kind of, I guess, like I said, bitch and moan without really without, you know, having earned the right to do so. So I was a member of NCPA already. I was a member of VPHA, APHA. I was a member of pretty much any organization I can get, but I was also, you know, and I still currently do sit on the Government Affairs Committee for VPHA. And so as I'm going through these processes, I'm just getting crushed on, you know, what I consider to be a not fair playing field. Like, I want opportunity, but yet my opportunities are smaller and smaller. And then my reimbursements get to the point where I can't depend on a consistent, you know, let's say 14% margin on cost of goods. All of a sudden it goes from 14 or 15% down to 7. Well, yeah. my operating expenses are not high, but they're still around 8%.
Yeah.
If you're paying me an average of 7% below acquisition, I can't pay the light bill. I can't pay the lease bill. So
right.
I started trying to, you know, just connect with other people to see everybody else was having the same problems, and connecting with local media and needing resources, which is how I got introduced to Monique Whitney, my executive director with PUT. She has a background in marketing and communications, and she was able to help reach out to a local reporter here. And we did a story or so. It was not an easy process to try to bring a reporter up to speed to be able to, you know, to be able to tell the story correctly. So we worked on that together. And after that, you know, just with my presence on social media, because that's really what I thought was the best platform for sharing information and ideas. And you know, that's one good thing that we've done well at PUT is that we've really have a strong social media presence. So that's kind of how I became intertwined with that.
What's that lawsuit you mentioned?
The punch lawsuit. Yeah.
Lawsuit. What was that again? I remember, I recall that, but
so it's been,
or what is it?
Yeah, it's been a couple of years. Mark Cougar's a lawyer in Philadelphia, and became interested in this. I think he was a friend of one of the original PUT establishers, and excuse me, he is good at reviewing state legislation and contracts with the PBMs and laws and such. And they came across the issue with, you know, Catamaran at the time, which ended up bought out by OptumRx with United Healthcare. You know, and ultimately that's it's been going on for quite a while. It's still, you know, it's going to be going on for a while. It took a long time in discovery because of the transition and all that kind of good stuff.
Sure.
But can't really talk a whole lot more about that, but hopefully that's going to be, you know, coming up soon.
And that had to do with the...
It's the MAC pricing and them breaking their own contracts on MAC pricing.
Gotcha. So, Scott, I've been on a lot of boards where I've got to be careful to show up to all the meetings, because if I don't, they're going to make me president or vice president or something like that. So in the case of PUT right now, was this something, as president of this, was this something that you were moving up towards and looking forward to it? Is it something that you got put in? I'm tongue in cheek because you didn't show up to the meeting. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I make a joke out of that too, just like anybody else would. You know, I crave information, and so I wanted to be, when I was inducted to the board, you know, we have once monthly board, you know, board of director calls that, you know, are pretty much, you know, outlined, and there's some open discussion stuff. But we also, the executive board will also have twice weekly meetings on Tuesdays and Fridays, just conference call. And I just
video too, or just conference?
Yeah, just audio. We just
gotcha.
Call. We either use a platform, or if it's just a couple of us, then we just merge calls. But
gotcha.
Anyway, we do that. You know, that's regular. I mean, there's only very few times where we don't have those calls, and usually it's because one of us are traveling somewhere and can't get on. But anyway, so I wanted to be a part of that call, and they were glad to have me, because one of the things that people don't realize is that even with our massive, you know, what I would consider a pretty phenomenal engagement profile in social media and the information that we get a hold of and We can talk about that information. I think that's probably a good topic as to how things get released and how things are, you know, kind of been exposed over the last few years. You can trace just about every one of those things back to a handful of our members who've gotten it into the right person's hands, which is kind of cool. So I just basically wanted to be more involved. I wanted to help to bring, we are small, so that's it. So we've, you know, there's really only about 3 to 5 of us that are actively working, you know, 40 plus hours a week on running the organization, and that kind of blows people away because we get pulled in a lot of different directions. And sometimes I have to tell people, look, there's like 3 of us right now that are working on about 17 different things, and we don't have the funding to hire a whole lot of people to do it for us.
So break that down. If there's 3 to 5 of you and you say 40 hours, you're all like putting in 5 to 10 hours a week on this outside of your regular jobs and so on, right?
Some weeks it's more than others, but, you know, it's gotten to a point where we've had to, you know, kind of instead of trying to tackle everything that comes across
yeah,
our
right.
face, was we, you know, we ultimately get have to prioritize whatever is most important, what we're working
right.
on, or if there's something crazy that's happening, then we have to redirect.
You got to drop it and then redirect it.
But yeah, I tell people that, you know, when it came time to you know, change leadership at the organization, you know, by the way, we're a nonprofit 501c3.
Okay.
We aren't we're donation only, basically, and, you know, it's membership driven, and we do have tax status for a little bit of politicking and such, so there's all that. But I basically tell the story like this, that I'm just the fool that was on the phone when they said, hey, shouldn't you be, you know, Scott would be a good president. And I'm like, yeah, okay, sure. Somebody's
right,
got to
sure.
do it. But, you know, our previous president, Teresa, had just had a baby and or was going to have a baby. And she was trying to step back a little bit. And ultimately, there was going to be a void. And you know, maybe Dawn would have been a better option. But I think that Dawn and I had talked about it. And she, you know, she said, look, I will do everything in the world in the background. But you've got way better. You've got way better people skills. So maybe you should just. Handle that portion of it, and that's kind of how this worked. Well,
does Putt use any paid staff at all, any paid position?
Well, none of the board members, based on our bylaws, receive any type of compensation, but we do have Monique, who's our executive director.
Nice.
And then she in the last year, just because of out of necessity, has been able to hire Shannon, who is her executive assistant. And they both are just incredible.
Yeah.
I can't say enough good things about those two. They really have a good grip on what we're dealing with as independents. You know, a lot of people can't really relate to our plight because they don't live it every
right.
day. So it's hard to find people who are as passionate about it as we are, but they've been down that rabbit hole and they're stuck. So,
yeah,
you know,
right.
their passion is, you know, very, very high. So.
Yeah. I remember in the old days, like my dad, he'd be on, well, I'm just guessing, but he'd be on the school board. Okay. So this is before fax machines and before email and all that. So when you were on the school board, you'd meet once a month. And in my estimation, it was a true meeting once a month. You'd meet and then a month would go
mm-hmm.
by. Nowadays, with email, you could be on a monthly board and you could be doing something every single day. So you guys are on 2 calls a week, but you're probably firing stuff back and forth like all day.
Oh, yeah. We've got the board on, you know, on group texts and group emails, and, you know, the information that we are exposed to, and most of the people on the board are pretty good. And kind of why we have certain individuals or I guess personality or character types we look for because of their engagement. I'm really good at finding obscure information, and I'll tell kind of a funny story about that if you want me to. But
absolutely.
So back last year with the CVS Aetna merger, going through that process, I just happened to read a really obscure, you know, article because I was up late, and that's what I do when I'm up late, and I just read as much as I can. And you know, we're on a Friday call, and It was about the judge get Judge Leon getting upset with the Department of Justice and CVS for basically trying to make them rubber stamp this merger without going through appropriate process. And you know, at the end of our calls, you know, Monique always says, "Well, the, you know, you or Dawn or Teresa have anything else that you want to share?" And I'm like, "Hey, did you guys see that article where the judge just like raked over the Department of Justice, and they basically were trying to say that the merger was finalized, but yet the public comment period won't even close until like the middle of December, and this was in November, and they're like, no." So I, you know, found the article and I sent it to them, and next thing you know, we were, you know, splitting the cost of hiring a lawyer to file a Tooney Act lawsuit against the merger on behalf of Putt and Pisney, is who helped us pay for that because it was quite expensive. Yeah. But we were there from day one, you know, even back in the early spring, causing some issues with other organizations because, you know, our head organizations hadn't really even come out and spoken against it.
Yeah, right.
You
right.
know, and we, here we are shouting at our lungs, don't let this happen. Don't let this happen. This is not yeah. going to be good. Every yeah. promise that they're going to make, they're going to break it. We already know that. Don't make the deal with the devil because it'll bite you in the end.
Yeah, right. Scott, how careful should, if at all, how careful should an independent pharmacy owner be with either on social media or through Putt or through writing a blog or through a podcast? How careful should somebody be as far as getting their hand slapped or getting their contract removed from one of the PBMs that got ticked off, or a lawsuit?
Very, very careful. And, you know,
you do have to be careful.
It's also a function of how, I guess, where your mind is in the whole idea of it. You know, I would usually use a bad word to describe it, but I have nothing left to give in that instance where I don't care, you know?
You don't.
Yeah, personally. So like, one of the things that, like NCPA hates about us is that we teach people how to create anonymous Twitter accounts. And they can not like it all they want to, but the problem is that we can't share information openly because it puts a target on us.
Right.
So, you know, the anonymity helps people to hide, at least with Putt as members, hide behind the shield of Putt so that it doesn't come back to them when they share information. And let's be real, the chains aren't going to share the information. The only reason why we have any of the only reason why we're even here today where we're at, where there's states all over the country and there's a national conversation and there's news articles written out of Ohio and there's, you know, a whole industry of data analysis that's developed out of this, is because we as independents were able to, contrary to what contracts tell us that we can't share information, shared it because we could do it without fear of repercussion. Because we do have examples of pharmacy owners that didn't take those precautions to be anonymous and were threatened or were audited out of business, basically, in retaliatory type tactics. So they're very real. So what I say to the people who don't think that we should, you know, have anonymous Twitter profiles is, A, I don't have one because I'm not throwing a bunch of stuff out there that I shouldn't. B, I don't care anymore. I don't do anything wrong in my billing processes and I stay very squeaky clean. So you can audit me all you want to. If you play fairly, you're not going to find anything, but, you know, there is that risk still, being the president of an organization or a board member of an organization like this that would open you up to a pretty sketchy or egregious audit practice. So the anonymity is very important. People need to be very careful when they're out there on social media, what they're posting. If it gets back to them, they absolutely can be retaliated against and they absolutely will get threatened and they absolutely will get a call from their PSAO. They'll get a call from the PBM and they will ultimately get an audit or be kicked out of network.
And would those be, of course, those are not fun things to happen. Is there also the threat of a libel suit or anything like that?
I think that that's probably like, you know, I think in a normal, you know, contract situation that that's really one of your only options, but we're not in a normal contract. I mean, we're dictated these rules. We're dictated what we can and cannot do. And they have so much power that why waste the time? They can just audit you out of business. It only takes one or two.
They don't have to threaten with libel suits because they're not going to get a lot of money from someone if they win a libel suit. They're just better off just kicking you out if they want to. How much anonymity does Putt provide? Because it seems like if they get mad at Putt, they can just look up and say, okay, well, Scott's the president and Don's this, so let's find out where they work and remove their contract because they're part of the place that did that. So it sounds like it's a filter, but you have to be careful still.
It would be very difficult for a PBM to come in and audit one of or all of our board members egregiously because of our prominence. I mean, we would have that spewn all over everything. And our legislative contacts would, I think, at that point would probably step in. I work with dozens of lawyers that call me for information. I could easily find someone that could undo a lot of that. It would be hard for them to effectively. Can they do it? Absolutely. I don't think they could do it without repercussion.
Then you guys can go to the press or whatever and say, look, they're all of a sudden auditing the top, you know, brass of Putt. It's like, we must be saying something. We must be saying something right if they're coming after all of us.
Well, it's less about contract and more about self-preservation for them at that point. But just to be clear, like I don't sit around and pull data out of my system. I rarely would ever even look at a lot of that stuff. I don't have to. Our membership and our, you know, potential membership share that with us relentlessly. And half the time, the stuff that we put out, I don't even see it. That's done, you know, through our, mm-hmm. our leadership, our executive director's office. And, you know, most of it we might help to interpret it or, you know, help functionally show how to best present it in simpler terms for people. But other than that, like we don't, like I know that my board, for instance, it's rare that data actually ever comes from us for that reason. We don't share our own. And a lot of days, yeah.
And a lot of times you're not even stepping out with your own comments. You're saying,
correct.
Putt says this. So that's kind of the corporate veil or the non,
yeah,
you know, the
nonprofit,
the group veil, you might say.
Yeah. I mean, data comes to us now. We used to kind of seek it out, but we don't have to really do that anymore. If I come across stuff that people are posting that I think opens them up for, you know, possible retaliatory stuff, I will share stories with them or ask them to remove it and then provide it to us so that we can put it behind, you know, the group, the organization's, you know, strategy. So I don't know. We wouldn't be where we are with PBM exposure and education if it wasn't for that particular way of doing things.
At least some level of protection.
Yeah, like gag clauses, you know, the gentleman out of Louisiana who basically helped spring the whole gag clause issue in full, you know, coverage from state and federal level even now, that wouldn't have ever happened if it wasn't for one of our members talking about it openly enough to get some attention to it and showing this is what they're doing with callbacks, and this is why they don't want us to say anything. It's a gag clause.
Right. If he had to do it all by himself, he'd be shut down somehow way before that. And maybe even, who knows? Who knows when you're playing with that kind of power, mm-hmm. what kind of things they can do?
Mm-hmm.
Scott, if you could capture what you say Putt's mission is, I know it's Pharmacists United for Truth and Transparency. Who is that for? Is that for the legislatures to see? Is that for the public to see? What is the goal? I know what I personally love having the information out, but what is the goal of getting out truth and transparency? Who is going to run with that then to help pharmacy?
So there's a couple of things. The first thing, our bylaws are written now or have been changed to basically say that, you know, our number one mission right now is the elimination of PBMs. And until the PBM issue goes away, if it ever does, then we dissolve. So we go away. It's written in a way so that PBMs are our main focus right now. And, you know, our mission is basically to get them out of the middle.
Gotcha.
That's a singular mission. But the truth and transparency portion is very important because that's how you get to that end game. We all see the egregious stuff that they do every day. We all see the way it affects our patients and our businesses and our ability to take care of our patients and our businesses and our communities ultimately. And, you know, truth is a way of shedding light on that black hole of a process. You know, we don't release data or we don't release visuals or graphics or white papers or any of the stuff that we produce without making sure that it is 100% true, that it can be verified or validated. And we're very careful about that. So, you know, if you ever hear anybody say that, oh yeah, well, that's not true, or this isn't the complete truth, that's bull. That's what we focus on. And that's how we make sure that our information is useful for everybody so that it can be so that it can't come back. They can't come back and say, yeah, well, they're making this up. The other thing, apart from the transparency thing, this is a really important topic. And I think most people would agree as fellow owners that might be listening to this. I think that every single independent in the country right now would open their books and their contracts and everything that they do from the top down if it were required by legislation, or if there was an avenue to do so without having, you know, a PBM pull a contract. We are open and transparent because we're on the moral right side of what's going on. We've nothing to hide.
Right.
You can see any rebates that I get. You can see any deals I get, any drugs I buy for, what I've bought. You can see it all, my financials. You can see every bit of it. I don't care because I've nothing to hide. From a transparency standpoint, the PBMs are really good at grabbing buzzwords and running with trying to control that conversation and redefining what that word means. And I'll give you a good background of that. You know, CVS has been touting the firewall for decades. A firewall does not mean the same thing that we all thought it meant because of that. They've taken that topic and transformed it into what idea of firewall was that they, you know, want it to be. And firewall doesn't mean that you can't get information back and forth, or the one umbrella portion of the company can't see what's on the other side. What they mean is that they've set up mechanisms so that people within the company can't see through it, but upper level management absolutely can. You know, just an example. I mean, you know, if CVS, the pharmacy, has an exclusionary contract, which they do through steering with Caremark, how convenient of them to be able to get that. Well, you can't have that with true firewall.
Right.
You know, but it exists. So how lucky of them that they got the contract to be exclusionary. How did that happen?
Just a small example. Every 3 to 5 years, I'm pricing my pharmacy to see where I am in the market and see if I'm worth anything still. But I was talking to, I won't give the name, but I was talking to this one chain about pricing us. And then I was also talking to this guy that supposedly used to work at this chain like 5 years ago. And we signed this non-disclosure thing with both and so on. And, you know, we went to both of them separately to try to see where the difference was and all this. Before you know it, these guys are giving us some malarkey about, yeah, we were just, it just happened that your city came up and, you know, it's like, I mean, they're like in bed together and here they are telling me that it just happened to come up. So there's no freaking firewall.
There's no firewall. And so they managed to convince, you know, the powers that be, the regulators, and, you know, that there's this firewall, and it's a sham of a firewall. Well, they're trying to do the same thing now with the definition of transparency. And so when we talk about transparency, we want transparency across the entire supply chain. We want it for manufacturers. In fact, there was a bill that came up in Virginia in the House subcommittee about 2 weeks ago. And, you know, our executive director with VPHA, Christina Berea, spoke for it because we want transparency. Well, so Christina spoke for this bill and gets a text message, you know, 10 minutes after that there were some upper level pharma execs in the room and they were very upset that she testified for this bill. And I looked at Christina because I was up there with her and I said, you don't owe them anything. They haven't gotten up and spoken for of our PBM bill. Maybe they haven't spoken against it, but there's a political interest there. You know, we don't owe them any. So if we're going to be transparent, transparency is not a buzzword that only applies to certain business practices yeah. or certain businesses. Transparency, it should be across the board from step one all the way to step 10. And so we are open to it. Our members are open to it. PBMs obviously aren't because everything is, oh, well, that's proprietary. You know, that's such a bull crap argument.
Yeah.
You know, transparency is not what we can't allow them to define what transparency is. And that's kind of what they're trying to do right now.
Everybody's willing to be transparent on stuff that doesn't matter. But when it comes to if it's the one piece of DNA or the one link in the chain or the one ingredient in Kentucky Fried Chicken or something that makes it. And if you're hiding that one thing, well, then you're not. You can be transparent on 99% of the stuff, but if it's at 1%,
exactly.
You're not transparent on the whole 100 doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. Not a bit, you know, and that's kind of where we're at with the transparency thing and part of that mission. So, you know, we're for transparency. I mean, I'm for transparency from the medical side, the hospital side, the entire supply chain from A to Z. It needs to be open because if it's not, if there's, like you said, one portion that's missing, then that's the one portion that will take up 90% of, you know, if you're trying to be transparent on where the money is, 90% of the shady stuff will happen in that 1% that's not transparent.
That's right. Let me ask this, Scott. So if we break the term down, pharmacists, truth and transparency, we've talked about that. Are there any issues as far as the second word, united? And let me ask this.
Oh, yeah.
When you say united, for me, that sounds like a great term. It's united. But as I'm thinking about it here, are there troubles ever with the united where even the people don't join PUT because they don't want to be united in a certain front? And is there any discussion inside of PUT to say we're united? And I'm not implying that you're not. The question is, are there any challenges to what united means?
Oh, yeah. And I think that even if we didn't use it in our, you know, in our name as a profession as a whole, this has been one of my biggest complaints is that there's so many different avenues of opinions, and let's face it, we've all got large egos. We all think we're doing things the best way.
Yeah, we're all independent.
I've seen so many conversations where, oh yeah, my way is the best. Oh yeah, my way is the best. And, you know, to come to a consensus on that for us is difficult, but participation is, in general, to unite. And even amongst the organizations, I mean, you know, I say this all the time. If our leadership and our national organizations have been successful the last 25 years, then PUT probably wouldn't exist. So yeah, so I you know, from a standpoint of the national organizations, you know, PUT is more of a kind of a guerrilla warfare type group that exists because playing nice hasn't worked, and the reason why is because playing nice, you know, doesn't consider the fact that the enemy is playing dirty. And that's exactly why we exist. And we want to be loud. These are, you know, our members are loud. They're angry. They're, you know, losing relationships. They're divorcing. They're you know, sometimes we've talked people down from, you know, potential suicide because of this. It's ruining their lives. So, you know, when we have interactions with other groups, you know, either on the state or national level, you know what those organizations are.
Right.
We don't have a great reputation, and even after the fact of me coming into the office as president and reaching out and trying to form those relationships to be functional, I can offer them something that, you know, that should be appealing, and that's that we don't mind playing dirty in the background. We don't need to take credit for anything. You can take all the credit. There's many, many situations where that's happened in the last even year or two, where some big things happened and we were very much in the background supplying the information for it to ever happen, or help organizing and uniting the different organizations to functionally release such information. And we won't show up on any talking point that in a, you know, a talk or a conference, or, you know, how did that happen? You know, we rarely will get thanked, but we're not there for that. We just want this stuff exposed. So, you know, keep playing nice at the national level. Keep playing nice at the state organizations and the state national organizations. We don't mind being the ones that do, you know, we don't want to play. We want to fight in the trenches, and that's okay. I think that that's a necessary thing to do.
Because from the beginning, PUT has always been that. They've been more of the guerrilla warfare. If somebody was looking at PUT, besides just the information coming out, is that, and I love what you said about your mission, that you guys would be done. It, once PBMs went away, you'd been done. I mean, if that's not a good way to narrow down a mission, I don't know what is. If someone were to look at your guys' website or at the mission statement and so on, do you have anything in there? I know you don't use, I don't imagine you'd use the word guerrilla in there, but is there anything in there that lets people know that you're going to be the front, you're going to be the fighters and so on? Or how would you say people first come across that, knowing that you guys are willing to lay a lot of that on the line?
Ironically, originally it would have been very easy because there was a handful of us either running the group or closely affiliated. We even have some state chapters that have
Oh,
developed out of
okay.
it. And it, you know, it's not something we just set up a state chapter anywhere. There's got to be the desire
Right.
from the independents and push, or some, you know, they reach out to us and ask for help. But
Right.
ultimately, the social media engagement is how most of them find out about us.
Gotcha.
And you know, from a yeah, we're not. I don't. We don't put. I mean, our tr let me just plug the organization's website. If you go to truthrx.org. You know, we have a very professional website. It doesn't say we're guerrilla warfare fighters,
Right.
but you know, ultimately, you know, the front page of our website says our name, and then says a nonprofit advocacy organization founded by independent
Yeah.
pharmacists to expose the truth about PBM anti-competitive tactics.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the in a nutshell of what it is. You know, and TPA has a very similar mission, but they go about it a little bit more, you know,
Yeah.
politically.
Right.
You know, our members are actively engaging with the powers that be on social media to a point where, you know, they get a little bit upset sometimes with us for the way our members act. But I do remind them on occasion that every one of my board members are active members with those organizations as well. So if you're accusing our members of being a little bit over the top, they're your members too. They're just a little bit beyond patient now
Yeah.
because they realize how sentinel this moment is.
Right.
I've heard, and I'm sure you probably heard it too, where industry experts have said that there's a good chance that we lose, you know, 4,000 independents in 2020,
Yeah, right.
and in the next 5 years we could lose half of the 21,000 or so that we have.
Yeah.
Is that when we have to try to fix it legislatively, or that someone wakes up and says that there's a problem? Because it's going to cost a whole lot more money to do it then than it would now.
Yeah.
But ultimately, we all feel that. So, you know, Ironically, as loud as we are, we only have about 330 members.
Yeah.
We have obviously some well-funded members, or some that aren't. You know?
Right.
We have some that are a little bit more successful than others when it comes to store quantity ownership. And
yeah.
We've recently partnered with a couple of other groups. One in particular is one of the oncology associations that has a large like dispensing portion in their pharmacy, but they're being paid at the same crappy contracted rates for that or steered to specialty. And, you know, those guys have kind of joined in the fight. They're also fighting. They're a little bit better funded than we are, but we're glad to have them as members, you know?
As I see it, it plays out pretty well because we've all heard of good cop, bad cop. And we've all heard of, you know, there's people that come in with their figurative pitchforks, but there's also people that have to go in with, you know, pens and write stuff out and sign things in that. And it's probably hard for groups to do both. I mean, it's hard to have both set of tactics. And I think you put it well, where maybe on the surface, some of the groups say they don't want to maybe associate with the other groups, but in the background, I think they're thankful that you guys are playing possibly that you guys are playing the bad cop side. I think it needs it from all different angles.
Yeah, and you know, don't get me wrong, we have discussions within our board and within our membership, and there's people that want us to be way more, you know, aggressive.
Oh, more aggressive.
Yeah, and then there's people that don't want us to be as aggressive.
Right.
But we try to find the middle ground of representing our core membership, which are more aggressive types. You talk back about the unity question, you know. We have members that are obviously members of the independent pharmacy associations in those states or commonwealths. And then those other organizations that work with us, and some, like in Florida, you know, they've had issues with the state national organization at the state level there. And, you know, the independents didn't feel like they were getting a representative voice. So they formed their own organization, you know, and that's not a PUT organization, but we work very closely with that organization, obviously. And there's people that have influence in, you know, at those state chapters who think that they shouldn't be working with us or a rogue organization. And ultimately, it comes down to, you know, we're not saying anything that's not true. We're not putting information out there that's inaccurate. There is nothing that you can discredit in any of the stuff that we do. We are a unifying group, and that's really what the mission is to unify organizations, because we're all over the place, and when we come into a state to help bridge those gaps, it works very, very well. We've got proof of it in places that's been successful, where we've, you know, ultimately we're not out to try to usurp any state group. We've never even talked about doing that. We're not trying to replace anybody. We're not trying to replace, you know, the national organization. We're not trying to do anything to stop what they've already. In fact, it's to our behest to work with them because they already've got the infrastructure there. So when we've had successful support of a state organization, you know, that's the ultimate goal. If we work with Illinois, we want to work with the Illinois Pharmacists Association. If they're engaged with us, then we've got very successful models where that's been effective.
Yeah,
If they're not willing to work with us, then it is a contentious situation, because if we see that there's work to be done, or if there's urgency in a state and we are involved in it, we're not going to kowtow to that organization and allow them to, you know, screw the process up when it's that critical. We will certainly input our opinions, and our membership will scream as loud as they need to make sure that it's done correctly. So, you know, there's a lot of, once again, a lot of egos and a lot of people who think they do things the right way. But ultimately, the question is that if on this topic of the PBM debate and PBM legislatures, is your state organization representing the independent pharmacy owners where most of their money comes from appropriately?
Right.
Or are they not really into it, or not reaching at least a semblance of the passion and understanding of what it is that we're dealing with.
Right.
If they have that and it's disconnected, then there is absolutely a contentiousness between them.
Well, I've watched some of those Netflix shows. I think it's called Broken, and they go through each edition goes through a different part of the food industry. And I think it was either the chicken farmers or I think it was the chicken farmers.
Seen that one. Yep.
Where these guys, I mean, they'd put on hoods, masks, and they'd go out in their pickup with baseball bats and pipe bombs and things like that. And they would do physical violence to these places. And so my point on that is that if anybody thinks a group like Putt, who's under the threat of getting your own stores taken, the contracts taken away and all that kind of stuff, if they want to see someone who's gone far, they've got to watch that show and then realize that there does seem to be room between, you know, pipe bombs and larger national associations that somehow seem to be sleeping with the PBMs a little bit because they don't seem to be fighting hard enough. And so those chicken farmers look like make you guys look like a dance class or something from what they were doing.
Yeah, and honestly, it's probably because it's cost too much to pay people to be at our stores while we go out and do that.
So. Yeah, right. That's true.
We can't get off to do it, so we got to be at work.
That's true. Well, hey, there's all, but you guys aren't open 24 hours though. You could get a pickup at, you know, 10 p.m. or something like that. But
I don't know. I don't sleep a whole lot, but I do a lot of work after hours. So it's stuff I can't get done during the day. But most of us are just tired. We are working hard. We're not being reimbursed properly for what we do.
For sure.
And so, you'd have to have the energy to do that as well.
Yeah, you gotta have the energy. Maybe some of the tools too. I think when you're a chicken farmer, you already got the pitchforks and all those kinds of stuff. If you had to do your own organization, let's say that someone says, Scott, there is no Putt or, you know, whatever, you're in this mythical world where Putt doesn't exist. If you had every say to form your own organization like this, what would you personally change, if anything?
Change from which standpoint? From like the current status of our organization or
the current setup of Putt? If you could go in there and say, all right, guys, this is good. I'm the president. You know, this is working fine. But let's say you could write your own script for an organization. And let's say it's still in the same atmosphere of all the challenges that we independents are facing. Would you change anything about an organization if you had every way you wanted it?
Well, I mean, yeah, if it had every way I wanted it, we would have like unlimited funding and we could actually put boots on the ground in every state to do the fight. I mean, ultimately, that's what our biggest challenge is membership, because actually membership numbers with if there's, you know, let's just say 21,000 independents and considering multiple store ownership, you know, there's quite a bit of pharmacists that are still out there that either A, haven't heard of us, which is not surprising when you've still got pharmacists who don't know what DIR fees are that own stores.
Yeah.
That happens. And, you know, membership numbers. So when we show up to a state, you know, and let's just talk about from we're working with the state organization. We encourage membership at the state level, organize with your state, you know, national like DPHA or NCAP or, you know, every state has one of those organizations. Start there, obviously, and get us involved when you need the support, because, you know, we know what needs to be shown or given to the legislators, but we need to be able to show up and say, well, we have 30 members in Virginia, or we have 100 members in Virginia. You know, I think that Florida, we might have the largest bit of membership, maybe Arkansas. But they're a very powerful group when they go to speak to legislators because there's so many of them. And we can use that as an influential tactic when talking with legislatures. We're here representing 12,000 independent pharmacists instead of 300.
Right.
But with that, obviously, you know, comes the membership amount, because, you know, we do fly all over the country. In fact, I think Monique's in Wisconsin, you know, speaking today. You know, we go and talk to different places, and we spend time with state organizations in some cases to work, like LIFA down in Louisiana. They have a very strong independent pharmacy association that we provide a lot of support to. And so there's some travel involved, and there's some expenses involved with that. And
what does boots on the ground look like? Is it having people actually, pharmacists actually able to go to the state capitol, for example?
Yeah, absolutely. And but even more so, just to have a presence, like our organization to have a presence. I mean, it's one of those things that were absolutely necessary for the, you know, for exposing the information, you know, and then to be to help, I guess, to support our membership there, for us to show up, for me to show up, for Monique to show up, for Dawn to show up, for Owen Sullivan in Illinois, for Amy Rogers in Arkansas, you know, for Lauren in Illinois and Missouri. And, you know, it's one of those things that we want to be able to say, hey, we're here, and this is what your membership gets. And we, if you look at a lot of the videos in the past 2 years of Senate subcommittees or House subcommittee hearings where we've had either our members or their organizational leadership testifying, look on top of that desk and you'll see putt graphics all over it. And people, that's what comes with the membership, is that type of support. And those graphics aren't free. You know, that we have to pay for those things, and or hire or get a really talented board member. I'm hoping that we got one here real recently, but that'll be later down the road. But it's one of those things that it costs money to run an organization, and we are very good about not spending where we shouldn't and spending where we should. But ultimately, it's a costly endeavor in general to be that engaged.
So we're talking financial. When it comes back to your first point, though, of boots on the ground, that's actually faces showing up at things, right?
Oh, yeah.
And then in your magical world of Scott, you know, if you had your thing, it would be more members.
Yes.
Let's come out of that fantasy world. What does it take to be a member in PUTT?
The desire to end PBMs in their current existence. Financially, we are just a donation membership, so we don't really have members. We have donations, you know, for the most part, our donating, our contributing membership. You know, we ask for 50 a month. Certainly with 3,000 members versus 300, it wouldn't need to be that much. We're only going to, we're only going to spend what we need to do the job and nothing more. You know, certainly there's, I mean, we have, it's a suggested amount. I've got people who are monthly members. They, you know, they give us a credit card and they say, well, I can do 25 a month. They're a member, you know. If I've got several that are multi-store owners that do 200 a month. They're a member, you know. There's people that will make a large one lump sum donation. They're a member, you know what I mean? So ultimately just putting, look, my biggest thing with people I speak to, and I've got some folks that I've literally had to say, I can't have this conversation with you anymore because I've got stuff to do. You've either got to put in your sweat equity or your financial equity, but you can't do neither. And that's one of the things. So, I mean, if we've got people who are actively wanting to engage in getting work done but can't really afford to join, you know, put the sweat equity in. I've been there. I still am there. I don't have the money to go throwing out anywhere willy-nilly if I don't see a good return on that investment, but I do have my sweat equity.
Yeah.
And that doesn't have to necessarily be with PUTT. That's across the board. I don't, you know, do I care if you join PUTT or not? Absolutely. Ultimately, get involved.
Yeah, because the first thing you said is, it almost sounds like the money follows. First, you have to have a commitment to reforming or getting rid of the PBMs.
Yeah. So, you know, there's too many of us sitting back, you know, waiting for our businesses to collapse still. I mean, if that's not a catalyst to get involved, I don't know what is. And we have been obviously more involved as a, you know, pharmacists owning independent pharmacies than we ever have been. But the states that are really successful right now never lost engagement. You know, Georgia,
yeah,
you know, Louisiana, South Carolina, you know, those, you know, New York, they've all had strong organizations that maintained the status quo the entire time, you know, and that was based on some very good involvement 10, 20 years ago.
Right. Someone's listening to this now in their car. As soon as they stop, what's the very first thing they should do as far as at least touching the organization? Would it be hitting your website?
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much information there. There's a little bit more resources when you're, you know, when you're signed up on the website and a contributing member. Yeah. But if you're not, most of our stuff is still there for people to go under the resources tab.
Give us that website again.
TruthRx, TRUTHRX.org.
That's easy. TruthRx.org.
Mm-hmm.
Scott, what do you do if someone says right now, hey, Scott, we're going to stop time. We're going to stop putt in time. We're going to stop your pharmacy in time. You're not allowed to do anything pharmacy related, but we're going to give you a year just to do whatever you want to do. You've got the money to do it. What are you doing for a year outside of your profession?
I will teach myself anything with a YouTube video and a tool that I would need. I'd flip houses or learn to weld or fix something. I love to do, I love to.
Something with your hands.
Oh yeah. I love being outside. You know, I'm kind of ironic that I'm in a job that I'm inside 12 hours a day, but I crave the sunlight. I love to do yard work. I love to dig. I mean, stuff like that.
That's cool.
I love to recondition, make stuff new again that's broken. Like take a lawnmower, a small engine apart, put it back together, make it work again, paint it, you know, restorative stuff. I love doing that.
One of my favorite things I did was, shoot, this is now like, golly, this is 25 years ago. It was redoing my basement at my first house that I had. And I would just go down there at night and just stand there and look at the work that I did. And when I finally finished it, and I'm talking some drywall and old carpeting and stuff like that, when I was finally done, that gave me so much joy and satisfaction.
Oh, yeah.
And a friend told me one time, I said, I don't know why that is. And he said, well, I like to do it. And he was a pharmacist. He said, I think it's because in pharmacy, when you come in the morning and you leave at night, you've done a good job, but your store looks exactly the same.
Yep.
And with fixing stuff and creating stuff, you're able to see that progress, which you believe it's there in pharmacy, but you don't always see it happening.
Right. Yeah, and I have a 15-year-old Craftsman riding lawn tractor that, you know, I've always kept running well, and it looks brand new because I, you know, 2 years ago I sandblasted the lawnmower deck, took it all apart, you know, redid the carburetor and fuel lines and repainted it, you know, the base coat, clear coat, everything.
Wow.
It looks like it came right off the factory line at this point and runs like it's brand new, but it's just enjoyable to do that. Like, it was a fun project.
How did you get into pharmacy?
By kind of on purpose, but by accident. I had, my father is a retired pharmacist, and he kind of a miserable old SOB, but he was also in the military and Navy pharmacy. And so they just did things a little differently. And so, you know, my dad, as a person who I didn't think enjoyed what he did, I figured I, you know, as a younger person, I blamed it on pharmacy, but it was just him being miserable. And then I got married and had a child really young, and I had a degree in chemistry. I have a BS in chemistry from Randolph-Macon College. And I was like, well, I want to take care of my family and, you know, I want to make decent money. And I knew my father made decent money in retail pharmacy. So I applied and got in and mostly went to pharmacy school for the money because I thought that I was just prepared to be miserable for the rest of my life. And while I was in pharmacy school, I worked for Rite Aid.
You were prepared to say, I'm going to be a pharmacist and I'm going to be miserable?
Well, I was prepared to be an unhappy person like my father traditionally had been.
Even in pharmacy?
In spite of it, because of the money.
Gotcha.
So when I was in pharmacy school, I took on a job because I had a family and I still had to make a little bit of money with Rite Aid. And I was put into a store with two fantastic pharmacists who loved what they did every day. And I basically said to myself, well, obviously my father is this kind of miserable person. These guys love what they do. And that's when I found my passion. I loved playing baseball. I was decent at sports in high school, but I wasn't meant to be a professional baseball player. I was meant to be a pharmacist. And it's just what I'm good at.
When you went to Rite Aid and met these couple guys, you were already a pharmacist?
I was a student. I was in pharmacy school.
You were a student. But if you didn't find those guys, you would have just been, you would have gone to pharmacy and said, it's worth the money. I'm going to be miserable. But because you found these guys, you were able to say, I'm able to find some passion in pharmacy.
Well, that's when I was aware of the fact that there's some passion there. I would have found it regardless,
yeah.
But it was just good to actually have some confirmation that what I was doing was not just because of that.
Yeah, you just realized your dad was miserable, but he would have been miserable. He would have been miserable doing whatever.
Yeah, and I got a kind of personality. I could be happy being a trash man as long as the day is fair.
As long as the day's what?
Fair.
What does that mean?
No, that I'm not that I can do my job to the best of my ability without having to worry about if the other players in the scenario aren't trying to put me out of business, undercut me, abuse me, or possibly steal from me.
So you'd be a trash, you'd be a sanitation worker, I have to call him. You'd be a trash man as long as everything seemed fair. Right now, though, you're in a profession where it's the opposite of that.
Well, I would be happy being a trash man. I don't think I would really want to be, but I could make the most of it, is what I'm saying.
If people were playing fairly, but now you're in a profession where that's not happening.
Right.
Yeah.
So I found the second passion in the advocacy. So, I mean, you know, I am not traditionally a negative person.
Right.
I try to remain positive. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I can say that I've seen a lot of things that somebody said that this is too crazy to believe that's been true. I've seen, you know, overall, I'm not really that, there's a lot of positivity amongst, I guess, leadership of our profession in general, when it comes to, you know, survival and how the profession's going. I'm not that optimistic about it right now.
Right.
And it's because of the things that I'm exposed to and see. And
yeah.
I don't see how we're going to make it too much longer right now. I am a member of CPSN. I'm traditionally trained as a clinical pharmacist. That's the way I was taught and brought up in pharmacy school. And I'm all for, I was probably, if not the first, one of the first vaccinators in Rite Aid. I helped develop that protocol and that plan when I was just out of school. I've been engaged with doing that since day one of my career. And I just don't see the structure or the payment model built well enough yet for the time frame that we're working with when it comes to survival. It's just not there.
Yeah, I don't disagree.
If we don't figure out how to fix the reimbursement model in its current construct, we're on borrowed time right now, and a lot of us are literally borrowing money to buy time.
I'm in that situation, you know. I'm in that situation as I sit here in the pharmacy.
There's very few of us who aren't, believe me. And if they aren't, it's because they've got pretty deep pockets.
Scott, you said that you were prepared to be miserable in pharmacy, yet you say right now, and I can see that despite this topic, that you're a positive person. Would you say there was a time in your life where you switched from negative to positive, or were you always pretty positive? You were just prepared to be in a miserable situation.
I'm always pretty positive. I mean, it's not really, the story is way much better when you embellish stuff like that. So it could just be part of the story. I mean,
wait, what's part of the story?
The part where my father was miserable. I figured that that was his cause. I was young, but you know, if my dad used to be a positive person, pharmacy took it away from him in my mind, you know?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, people have, you talked earlier about people that can be suicidal, losing families, divorce, and all that stuff. And when you're living constantly in a situation that is not, you know, fair, you pick up even some, you know, post-traumatic stress or complex post-traumatic stress. I mean, it can change people.
Well, all of us are here because of our egos in one shape or another. Like I've said before, I mean, you know, who can open up a business like this and take that risk without having a huge ego? You can't. How much control of it, it's a whole different argument, but we all have relatively big egos.
I think you're right.
This situation will tear an ego right out of you and knock it down so many levels that you start to second guess decisions. You start to second guess, you know, your abilities. You start to second guess everything. And if that ego isn't left intact, you know, it changes your whole outlook on everything.
All right, let me ask this. I am a third generation pharmacist. So my grandpa started the store, mm-hmm. or bought the store. Then my dad, they're both passed away. And now I am here as the owner. I've got a big ego, but I don't attribute it that I would need it to become the third generation owner, because quite often, even though I am the owner, you get slapped so much by the PBMs, you almost feel like a manager versus an owner. Now, your dad owned that pharmacy before you came in?
No, my dad worked for me for a few years before his health deteriorated a little bit. Well, let me ask you this. If your grandfather and you if your grandfather and your father both handed down a successful business to you and left you with the responsibility of possibly handing it down to one of your kids, and you lose it, what's your ego feel about that?
Well, you're exactly right, because I'm
yep.
facing that right now, where I'm still sitting in the pharmacy. I have no freaking idea what this would do to my ego, because I'm still here. And I can imagine it, but mm-hmm. if it ever comes where I sell or lock the door or someone else buys it and keeps it going or something, I have no idea how that's going to feel, because right now it's crazy because my ego's down because of getting slapped by the PBMs, but it's actually kind of up because it's one of the first times that I feel like it's mine, because I'm really fighting for it.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of two different avenues to look at it. I tell you what, my ego would be left intact if I didn't have to wake up every morning and look at my bank account.
Yeah, right.
You know, if I was, you know, my ego would be left intact if I can say that I ran a successful pharmacy for 20 years, and then in the last few years the PBMs have stolen it from me. My ego stays intact, you know. If you're starting a business right now and you're unaware of how hard it is, your ego is going to take a beating like it's never taken before.
You're saying, and I think I agree with that, that I'm like, look, I've kept my ship intact. My ship still sails. I can't help if there's a hurricane out there. So it has nothing to do with how I've run this ship. Is that what you're saying, that if you get taken out now, your ego is okay because you know that the outside influences are so strong that it's just not an ego buster?
Exactly. But that might be the reparation part, where we've been already down that path, and back to what we're talking about with relationships and destruction of you know, marriages and you know, going down that path. I mean, I'm going to come to terms with it because I've done the best that I could, and I know that I'm capable. You know, not everybody gets to that point before they lose it all, or before they're losing everything around them. There's a certain, war or battle that you go through to get to that point internally and externally, obviously. And that's kind of where I'm at with the whole not really trying to hide behind an anonymous name. I don't have anything else to lose. You know, when I first opened, I knew that I could be successful because I understood how the business of pharmacy worked
right.
from a financial side standpoint, from, keeping track of not overspending dollars where they don't need to
yeah.
go. Even to this day, I spend hours shopping 17 different
yeah.
secondary wholesalers to make sure I'm not overpaying.
Right.
I've maintained a lot of that control. So, I have a very low days on hand. It's probably lingering around the 16 area because I use my technology to predictively fill stuff
gotcha.
And order it when I
yeah.
need it. You know, all these things that you would do, I don't overstaff. I don't pay too much for my staff, obviously, in the market. I limit my expenses to needs and not wants.
Yeah.
And I've done all these things because I know that's the one portion that I can control. And if I've controlled that portion to a certain level of what I would consider, and I'm very hard on myself, exceptional,
yeah.
and I'm still failing, then there is nothing in my control beyond that. So when there's things that, so I've reconciled that. That's the reparation part. I've come to terms with the fact that you've done everything that you can, or at least that you're aware of. There might be some other opinions about that, but to the best of my knowledge and ability, things that should traditionally make you very successful in this industry and in the past would have, I've done all those things, and I'm still losing control. And that control is because I don't own it. It's on the payment side.
I'm really drawn into what you're saying right now. And I think it's because it's really, it's not a happy situation, but it's really speaking to me about saying, I've tried everything. But how do you get to that comfort level to know that you've tried everything? Would it have to be comparing it to what others have done, or how do you know when you've given it your all?
For me, it's comparing what over time, where I should be versus where I'm at, and the peaks and valleys in between. And I've just been, just because of the timing of opening and going through this, 7 years, I know where I got to a point where I said to myself, okay, this is where it should exponentially take off. And that's about the same time
yeah.
that my reimbursements dropped from an average of 21% to 7.5, 9, 10, 11,
yes.
and all over the place. I was there. I was about on the cusp. I had paid off any debt that I had already. I was starting to theoretically be able to pay myself, but I ended up investing more money into product and growth and trying to make more, margin.
Yeah.
And then it was pulled August 31st of that year, was 2017. The rug gets pulled out from under my feet. I
yeah.
just bought a $40,000 ice and water vending machine because the ice and water store next to me closed, and the hunting supply fishing store next to me got rid of their ice machine because there was a store next to me, and I had this nice $40,000 machine that I bought, and it's paid for and it's getting delivered.
Yeah.
And all I got to do is find the money to, $4,000 or $5,000 to put it in install. It's going to be 24 hours. It's going to pay for itself. And boom, I lose $92,000 in cash flow between September 1st of 17 and 12/31 of 17. And that damn machine is still sitting in the crate behind my store.
That's the exact time that we're looking at too. We say April of 17, but it was somewhere right in there in 17. And so what you're saying is you can look back from what you're doing now and saying, I'm doing so much more now, and I'm looking back at where I was, and I know what that momentum and that line would, that graph would have been, and then it dropped.
Yeah.
You know it's the hurricane out there and not your ship.
Yeah. And that's when I just about lost it all then, I was having trouble paying my primary, and ended up going from, you know, every 2 weeks to every other day, you know, terms.
Yeah, right.
I had the opportunity a year later to go back to terms, and I'm like, you know what? I don't even want it. Best thing that ever happened was is now I don't overspend at all. I just know how much money that I can spend for being able to pay that bill in 2 days, and that's it.
Yeah.
So I have a very tight inventory because of that. And you know what? I don't owe McKesson any money because of it.
Right.
And it's nice. I hated having every 2 weeks that bill come due and not have enough money in my account, or at least it cleared me out so I couldn't make payroll. Now I have some control over it.
Yeah, that sucks. That sucks to see that.
Well, like I said, at the time, that was my measure of ego failure, too, because how did I get to a point, like, you ask your rep, you know, if I basically go on COD, which is not really what it is, it's actually pay hits the account the day after, but
yeah.
If I go there, what are my chances for survival? And he basically said to me, you won't make it. That was 3.5 years ago.
When all the trends would say you're done, you're going to be done in 60 days, that's 3 years ago, but it's just not coming though. And that's what shows that this model is not going to, and its current model is not going to stay.
Well, the one thing I've always said is that, you know, we're all dying a slow burn, crash and burn here because, you know, as a small pharmacy, I still have $2 million in annual sales. That's a lot of cash flow.
Hadley, yes, it is.
And so we live off cash flow. And the more sales and turnover you have, the better your cash flow is. So, you know, I may lose money profit-wise annually, but daggone if that cash flow doesn't keep me in there for a long time to play that game. But it isn't improving. I wish it were.
Right.
You know? I mean, it was doing okay, and you start to settle out, and then boom, January 1st, Express Scripts Anthem contracts now, even though we're – you know, 2 years into a 3-year contract and they want to renegotiate it and we refuse as a PSAO to do so, but all of a sudden they've just redesigned the plans and offered the idea of y'all pick the pharmacy that you want to use to the health plans and 30% picked us and the other, you know, 70% apparently didn't. So boom, you lose 70% of your, you know, script volume, which not to mention, if you were thinking about selling, completely takes value out of your store because you get paid based on script count. All of a sudden, I can't bill 2/3 of the plans that I was billing, just a month later. You know, I've grown every month over year script volume-wise for 7 years straight.
Yeah.
And some were booming, some weren't. I'm still making the same gross on cost of goods that I was 5 years ago,
but
number wise, and I think everybody's experiencing that, but
yeah,
ironically, because of the Express Scripts, you know, steerage thing that just started happening the first year,
right,
I lost 280 scripts over the year prior in January.
Yeah.
Want to know something? My net on cost of goods increased by $4,000. Now that helps the bottom line, but if I were considering selling, that crushes my value because they don't give a crap if you're profitable or not. They want the numbers.
Yeah.
So another challenge, you know, now I've lost volume. I've certainly gotten a little bit better on the payment side because I've purged some brand drugs that were costing me a lot of money that way.
Yeah.
But ultimately, you know, and I've cashed out a bunch of things that I probably ideally might have wanted to do prior to that or not take insurance at all. That model might still exist to where it's feasible. I don't know if it is for each individual pharmacy, but for me, I don't think it is, but it might be, you know.
One of my friends, he always says, well, things only get so bad before the other side, what you thought was bad, looks better than what you're currently doing. What is your cutoff point? I mean, do you have a time where you walk away, or I mean, when you're forced, you always might decide to.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, don't get me wrong, every one of us who struggle has had this thought as to what the out looks like, and I think it's situational for each other. Maybe your lease is coming up, maybe you've been maybe you've been really pursued by a drugstore down the street,
yeah,
or whatever the case may be. But I think that, you know, ultimately the timing of it is going to be dependent on the individual situation. But I think we're all there already in our heads for the most part, unless
right,
you're super optimistic and you found a way to hustle the system.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people are good hustlers. I am not a good hustler. I don't want to be a hustler.
No.
You know? I just want to be able to take care of my clients and, you know, speak with them and save a life here and there,
right,
which I've done in this environment, which you
right.
can't do if you can't get paid to do it. I guess my biggest answer to that question is that everybody's situation is going to be unique, but I think we've all had the thought. And certainly if, when it comes to timing, you can miss a big opportunity to help mitigate some of the pain of it. One, you can actually be paid halfway decent for, you know, basically your hard work and dedication to get to that point, or whatever investment you made initially, and hopefully you can recoup some of it
by selling
with your family intact and your relationships intact. And then the other idea is what are you going to do next? I will never go work for a chain pharmacy on a bench ever again. This monkey's
yeah.
been let out of that cage. You couldn't pay me, and they aren't even paying that well anymore. You couldn't
right.
pay me twice what they paid me when I left to be able to do that. So, you know, I won't go do that. I mean, I could see myself, you know, I could see myself switching careers.
Yeah.
I could see myself switching straight up to advocacy if I could ever figure out how to monetize it.
Right.
You know, the information that I know and the understanding of the system that I have in its current form, it should be marketable, I would think, you know, but.
You and I are talking about something that's been through the head of every independent
yep.
pharmacy owner. Let me ask this, Scott. Pretend you got past the point of selling. All right. Pretend that nobody wants anything. Just pretend. What would be your, like, what would be the hour you close? Like when you run out of inventory, or when you or when it's dark inside your store, or
it's
what?
It's too late then. I think that when you start to see the effects of the intentional devaluing, and, you know, I'm seeing it now. You know, the fact that my business is worth less than it was a month ago because of my script volume being forced out of here. Now, can we pass legislation and hopefully stop it? You can pass legislation all you want to. If it doesn't have any enforcement, it's not going to matter. You know, it still happens.
But let's say you can't sell. All right, so this is what I'm in this situation where, all right, maybe I go on forever and I'm successful. Maybe I sell. Maybe I say, you know what, you're past the point of selling. At what point, there's a day of the week, let's pretend that those other options mm-hmm. aren't there. There's a day of the week where the door of the store doesn't open. Why is that? Is it because you can't buy drugs that day, or you can't pay your payroll, or what?
No, I've been in both of those situations and they didn't close me. So no, those aren't them.
What forces you to lock the door?
I say accepting the fact that I did everything I could and I'm going to lose more value in what I could get for it if I continue down the same path.
Gotcha. So it's like you'd be better off selling this inventory to someone down the road than selling it to this person walking in to buy a prescription or something like that.
It's more complicated, I think, than that. You know, I'll be honest with you. There's a whole group of people out there who chastise owners who are looking to sell to a chain, or instead of trying to find another independent owner. And I don't understand that mindset, other than I get it. Nobody really wants to sell to a chain, but I'll be
sure.
honest with you. If you're selling to an individual at this point, all you're doing is ruining another individual's life.
Sure.
I refuse to do that to my fellow independent owners at this point, where I hand them off a big steaming pile of loss, and they go and they're, you know, I've made it 7 years because of my skill set.
Yeah, right.
And maybe they don't have it and they're done in 6 months and they've lost everything that they have in 6 months. I couldn't live with myself.
Doesn't help anybody.
No. There are people out there that will argue, well, there's better ways to do it. I'm sure there is in your situation, but you don't have your business at 800 Battlefield Boulevard South, Suite 105-107.
It's all individual. Nobody can judge.
There is no cookie cutter right way to do it. There's some guidelines. And look, I've tried you need to be in CPA. Well, guess what? I'm not big enough volume for them. Oh, okay, you can't do that.
Yeah.
Or you need to get away from McKesson. Well, there's two other options and they're just as bad, only they wouldn't front me the inventory on the front end, you know?
Right.
It's like
yeah.
everybody's situation is different, and From a advice standpoint, I only really give it when I'm asked for it because I know that my opinion is not really advice. It's an opinion. And so is everybody else's. There are certainly guidelines, but there's no cookie. I joined PDF. I made the most of it. Didn't help me because I wasn't willing to hustle every day. Or the repercussions that come with it. People say, well, you need to be more involved in CPSN. I've been with CPSN since day one. I've been doing the clinical stuff regardless of my affiliation with them. I'm already there. But my particular situation in general is not going to be the same as yours. And so I don't try to judge. So like if people have advice to give, please understand that don't think that if someone decides to sell their pharmacy to other than an individual or they decide to get out, they're doing it with a huge, heavy heart that they've had to come to terms with. This is my baby. I love being here. If I ever chose to go down that path, the last thing that I need is some judgmental people saying, well, you just didn't know how to be a business owner.
Yeah, screw them, because nobody knows, and it's really no one's business what's on your heart. And they don't know that you're doing something noble by not letting another individual, for example, if you're in a situation, you're doing something noble by not letting that store continue. I mean, you're if you got to that situation, you're basically falling on your sword or covering up the hand grenade by not letting someone else buy it and 6 months later ruin their family.
Yeah, I've just seen it happen so many times. I mean, even around me, I've seen where, these entrepreneurs go in and open up and 6 months later, they're like, I don't know why I couldn't make this work. I said, because it's not set up for you to be able to survive.
Right. Well, Scott, you got a lot of wisdom. You're the right person to be president of Putt at this time. And so thanks for all your efforts.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
If I ever do decide to get out of the actual ownership part, I'm not going to step away from advocacy, so don't worry about that.
He'll still be in our face somewhere.
That's right.
Again, truthrx.org.
Yep. Sign up. We are really doing stuff for people. I mean, you may not feel like your other organizations are, and that may be a realistic viewpoint. It may not be. They're really good about touting what they do for us, but ultimately we want outcomes. But Putt actually is literally in our own self-interest as owners and on our board as owners trying to save this, the idea of independent pharmacy.
We may have a brighter future, but I mean, one of the models, this is probably why you don't want me on your board, because one of the models could be for an organization like yours, which, and that's why I love talking to you here, could be like misery loves company. You know what I mean?
Daggone right.
Someone understands someone else and someone cares. And what is that phrase? They don't know how much, they don't care how much you know until they know how much you care, or something along those lines. So
that's good, corny and appropriate.
All right, Scott, we'll be watching you.
All right. Thanks, Mike. Good to talk to you. Take care.
You've been listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Please subscribe for all future episodes.